Call cage, please. Good morning, counsel. Ready to proceed? Please.
Good morning, Honorable Chief Justice Moon, Honorable Associate Justices. Anthony Casabir, the petitioner, thanks you for granting his writ of certiorari. On appeal, the defendant argues that argues a number of points of error at the trial level, and that each individual point or all the points raised cumulatively substantially prejudiced his defense and therefore warrants a new trial. This defendant was charged with sexual assault in the first degree against his wife, Linnell Casabir. And I will proceed by summarizing some facts, salient facts that we think are important to consider, and then go down the points of error raised on appeal. The Casabirs, Anthony and Linnell, were married with two children. Anthony left the household approximately a month before the series of events took place, which were heard at trial. He voluntarily moved out of the household as they had been having difficulties, frequent arguments. So he moved in with his sister in Clehe. His wife remained at the home in Pearl City, and the children, for the most part, were cared for their parents in Waipahu, and but also spent time with their mother at Pearl City and also visited with the petitioner. The events that took place, and which were testified to at court, took place on April 9th and 10th, 2004, and took place at two different locations for the most part. One was an incident at the Hawaiian Village Hotel, where Linnell had gone to visit her friend at work, and Anthony had been driving with his friends. They saw his wife driving to that location, and they followed her at the hotel. They got out. Mr. Casabir approached his wife and noticed that she had severe injuries to her face, a black eye, a bleed, a swollen lip, and other cuts. He became jealous and accused her of having an affair, thinking that her lover had inflicted those wounds. It came out at trial that several nights before at a bar in Mililani that she had she testified that she'd fallen. She'd been there with her girlfriend. She'd fallen, and those large injuries to her face had been caused by that fall. Nevertheless, Anthony, the petitioner, was jealous, pursued her, accused her of having a relationship, and the encounter at the Hawaiian Village Hotel late in the evening of April 9th resulted in another argument. They parted. Mr. Casabir went home with his friend Andrew Kim, that is home to Mr. Casabir's sister's home where he was residing, and thereafter decided to go to the residence in Pearl City and further pursue this issue of the injuries as well as what he thought was an ongoing affair. He went there. He went into the residence with his friend Andrew Kim. They were there when his wife returned home. He confronted her. Difference in testimony at this point. She says she was grabbed and he slammed her to the floor, her head hitting on on the tile floor. He said was indicating that he just brought her to the floor. Inconsistent testimony on her part is exactly what happened. Confronted her again, accused her of having an affair, wanted to know the cause of the injuries. As it turns out, at the time she had entered into the Pearl City residence early that morning, this is the early morning of the 10th, She was talking to her girlfriend, Tabitha, who she had visited at the Hawaiian Village. Tabitha became concerned, hearing what was happening in the background, called Mrs. Casabir's parents, as well as the police. Father arrives, Mr. Casabir's father-in-law arrives, and the police eventually arrive. The matter is discussed. The parties go home. Mr. Casabir, the petitioner, goes home with his father-in-law to where his children were at the Waipahu residence. Mrs. Casabir stays at the Pearl City residence, and Andrew Kim goes home to his place. The police leave. Next morning, Mrs. Casabir, Linnell, gets up, visits a cousin, and testifies that she returned home to prepare for a lunch with her, with Tabitha, her girlfriend, at Tony Roma's. She says she entered her home in Pearl City, went into the bathroom, and when she came out, the petitioner, Anthony Casabir, was there, and he thereafter raped her, kidnapped her, holding her down, raped her. His testimony, Mr. Casabir's, is that when he awoke at his parents, Mrs. Casabir's parents, the Baron's home, went home to his sisters and decided he wanted to talk to his wife again. So he returned to the Pearl City residence, was in there watching television when she came in to prepare for lunch. He said they discussed matters and had consensual sex. A important witness for the prosecution of the case was girlfriend Tabitha, who arrived for the lunch engagement at the Pearl City residence. She knocked on the door, discovered the door was locked, knocked again. The Casabirs appeared at the door. She testifies that they were both there. Her friend, Linnell Casabir, looked anxious. She indicated that the petitioner was behind her and stood there while they engaged in this discussion at the door. That is Tabitha and her girlfriend Linnell Casabir. Now there are a number, and these are all pointed out in the brief. A number of what the petitioner submits are significant contradictions in the testimony, not only between the witnesses Tabitha and Linnell Casabir regarding exactly what was happened, what was said, but also within the testimony of Linnell Casabir to Detective Kim after the event, statements to the examining physician, Dr. Ten Saleh, as well as contradictions to other statements that she made, in addition to those made by Tabitha, her girlfriend. I'll just note a few. Importantly, there's an issue as to what was said to Tabitha by Linnell at the door when Mr. Casabir was standing behind her. Statements to the police, there was no clear indication of what was said by, this is an attest statement by Linnell Casabir to the police about what she had said. That is, there was the record is absent as to her own testimony, her statement about what was said. However, Tabitha indicated that at trial that in fact she had heard her girlfriend say that I've been beaten, Tony beat me. And this is I believe, a whisper to her. And then she goes on to testify that when she called the police officers and they came at the residence, she indicated that Linnell had told her she was raped. So inconsistency there as to the issue of rape.
Excuse me.
Yes.
You filed several points of error.
Yeah, six, I believe.
Do you consider the most important?
I think violations of the motion limine, Your Honor, as well as the admission of the gun. I don't feel testimony was introduced throughout trial about the presence of a gun. A gun was found underneath the mattress in the bedroom at the Pearl City residence. It was a licensed gun, licensed to Mr. Cassabear. He testified as to why it was there. It was never used. It was never explicitly referred to. A statement from Mr. Cassabear to his wife during the period of time when she was allegedly kidnapped and raped, was there any reference to the gun? So it was never seen. In fact, Mrs. Cassabear wasn't even aware that it was there or where it was. Police inquired of Tabitha when they arrived at the Pearl City residence, does Anthony have any weapons? She was aware that he had a gun, said he had a gun. The police entered and asked her, Linnell, where the gun was. She said she didn't know. There was no testimony that it was a gun. However, throughout the presence of the gun, and it was found at the residence, was built up. But at the conclusion of the state's case, they moved to introduce it, and defense felt there was utterly no information tying it in. We objected to the introduction of the gun, and although it doesn't appear in the record, I was trial counsel. I was surprised when I looked at the record. I would have assumed that I had that a motion to strike all the testimony. However, it doesn't appear on the record. So we are basically contesting the delivery of the gun into jury deliberations for examination consideration by the jury. And we feel that was significantly prejudiced.
Mr. Motto, would you elaborate some on your question for, as it appears in your application, was it error to fail to deliver a unanimous verdict instruction as to count for kidnapping? In effect, give us your argument.
Yes, there was a motion in limine filed by the petitioner asking that the events that took place early on the 10th of April, early morning, be excluded as prejudicial, and the alleged assault, slamming to the ground, and again, inconsistent testimony exactly what happened, be omitted as unfairly prejudicial, prior bad act. The court considered the arguments of the parties and ruled it be admitted.
April 9 was out, but the early event of April 10,
correct,
was allowed.
Yeah, and actually on April 9th, Your Honor, there was actually no alleged physical or psychological abuse. There were other allegations that earlier on in the relationships there were.
There was a motion in limine with respect to events that occurred on April 9th.
Across the board. Any prior? Actually, no. I don't believe. There was an argument or a confrontation at the Hawaiian Village. There was no alleged assault, just an argument that ensued.
So the circuit court or the trial court ruled, I'm going to allow the events of April 10 in, but nothing else.
Correct. And so the alleged physical assault and restraint by Mr. Cassabear that morning, holding her to the floor, was included as a judge felt it was close enough in time. And we feel that that act was an act of restraint and an act of, as was testified to, an act of inflicting terror accusations, that would constitute a kidnapping, and therefore the issue of an instruction, unanimity instruction in regard to that, as opposed to the acts early morning of the 10th, as opposed to the acts of approximately noontime on the 10th, as well as the arguments and closing, and also the facts as to whether there was restraint through threat. That is the argument on closing. What this was, this sort of an elliptical reference during the conversation between the petitioner and his friend. They had communications by mobile phone during this incident of noon when the rape allegedly took place. During that conversation, there was a brief exchange where the petitioner said, And this is testified to by Mr. Kim, Andrew Kim, his friend. Basically, he said, Andrew, you remember that thing you thought, that thing you hid, or you thought I didn't have? Well, I have it with me. It's here. And that's the extent of it. Now, it's argued that that is a reference to the firearm, and that, therefore, the presence of the firearm was an act of a threat, and therefore, and that threat constituted the restraint. Then there were other acts where she allegedly said that he held her to the ground, held her to the bed, her throat, forcibly, essentially, forcibly raped her. So those two are two different events, threats as opposed to actually physical acts of restraint. So it's submitted that depending on what was believed, and given the degree of contradictions, the contradictions in testimony and the credibility, I think, of the witness, the petitioner thinks the witness exhibited in their inconsistent testimony would raise questions on the part of the jury, and hence,
as to
whether the early event might have been believable, for example, slamming her down at the during the early hours of the 10th and holding her down, there were inconsistencies. She told the detective that she was brought to the ground, and then in testimony in court, she says she was slammed to the ground, her head hit the tile. So a juror, understandably, could just reject that in testimony entirely, however, find out or determine that those other acts constituted the kidnapping.
So your argument is that
there are three
that on the record, depending on what the jury believed, there was more than one instance of conduct that could have satisfied the conduct element of the offense charge?
Correct.
You were trial counsel?
Yeah, I was, sir.
Did you request a unanimity instruction?
I did not, Your Honor.
Why not?
At the time, I imagine my mind was focused on other things. It was, my mind was focused on other things, Your Honor.
Is that fatal to your position?
I think the since an objection or a request was not entered, I think that's it's certainly a point to be considered by the court. However, the facts of the case are the facts of the case, and although it wasn't requested, I believe there's a law that indicates that the court, irrespective of conduct of counsel, either counsel has a responsibility to make sure that complete jury instructions provided as warranted by the facts of the case.
You're arguing plain error.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you didn't object to the kidnapping instruction that was given?
I did not, Your
Honor. In final argument, the prosecution attempted to narrow which incident or the facts which would apply to the kidnapping charge. Is that correct?
Well, to the extent that they argue that the gun was reason why the gun was tied into it was that it was used to threaten her, intimidate her into compliance. To that extent, it was. Although he did mention these other physical acts in his closing argument, so I don't recall any specific indication to the jury that this was a specific act that would constitute the element that would fulfill the charge.
You didn't object during that argument with respect to what facts constituted kidnapping?
Correct.
As I understand it, part of the prosecution's argument is that for Arceo purposes, the prosecution made an effective election or a de facto election regarding the conduct it was relying on to prove that element of the kidnapping offense during closing argument. Assuming for the moment that the prosecution didn't argue the early April 10 incident in closing. What's your response to the prosecution's position?
It would be, as I indicate, I tried to indicate before, Your Honor, that although it did focus in and try as indicating that the use of the presence of a gun or the reference to the presence of a gun in that elliptical statement and the presence of a gun, even though it wasn't explicitly referred to, wasn't a method of intimidating or terrorizing the client, the defendant, or excuse me, the victim, alleged victim, into compliance. I don't believe that was clearly done. And then also the other.
Does Arceo permit an election during closing argument?
Certainly it does, yes.
Arceo permits the prosecution for the first time in closing argument to elect specifically what conduct it was relying on to prove the conduct element of the kidnapping offense?
My understanding is that if an election is made, and we would argue that the election has to be clear, that although there's no instruction, that would cure any defect in the court failing to offer a unanimity instruction. So if there is an election, a clear one, my understanding that would cure the defect or the failure of the court to issue an instruction. Although I trust Your Honor has a far deeper grasp of the law than myself.
Okay. You've answered my question.
Thank you. Was pointed out the failure, Your Honor, of the prosecution's witnesses to comply with the pretrial order of the court regarding allegations of abuse by Mr. Casabir against his wife was violated on three occasions, and there were curative instructions issued each time. However, viewing the facts of the case, in that it basically the testimony of Mrs. Casabir versus testimony of Mr. Casabir essentially had to be the turning point. There was no medical evidence to support the forcible compulsion of sex, and there were no other witnesses to it. So, and given the inconsistencies, as pointed out in the brief, of the testimony of between witnesses and within witnesses' own statements at trial as well.
Didn't Linnell testify to facts establishing, if believed, that she was subject to a first-degree sexual assault?
She certainly did.
And we're not supposed to get into weighing the evidence, are we? Making determinations of credibility, are we?
Well, I think we would argue that in determining the potential prejudice to the defense's case, a case where there may be very little, as pointed out, very little supporting or corroborating evidence to a witness, and a introduction of highly prejudicial facts against the defendant, which was specifically excluded by pretrial ruling repeatedly, one can come to the conclusion.
Asking us to hold that there was insufficient evidence in the record to establish sexual assault in the first degree, are you?
Not as a prima facie case, no, Your Honor.
I'd like to focus on a part of your question six in your application. Was it error when the trial court prevented the appellant from effectively confronting and cross-examining Linnell? Would you elaborate on that argument?
There were a couple of instances raised, Your Honor.
I'm familiar with the factual underpinning of the question. I'm asking you to synopsize your legal argument further to question six with respect to the complainant.
Again, Your Honor, the credibility of the complainant was essential to the state's case. Defense was inquiring on a point, and there was an unresponsive answer, and it was indicated that the complainant went on and on at length over a defense objection, making statements that were sympathy eliciting as well as irrelevant to the question at hand. So we attempted to stop that. We feel that was undermined the effect of cross-examination of the complaining witness, which was a central witness in this case. There was no one else to actually testify as to the events, no corroborating medical testimony.
What was it, in your view, that the trial court erroneously prevented you from doing with respect to your examination of Linnell?
If I could have a moment here. Defense counsel was cross-examining and attempting to refresh Linnell's memory about her inconsistent statement to Detective Kim. And
the prosecution objected to that, and that objection was sustained.
I believe that was asked, asserting that was asked and answered, I believe.
So that's what you're, that's the error you're...
Correct. And then the point of, yes. There are other points we argue cumulatively could have affected the jury deliberation one, a single statement by the court indicating that an offense had been committed. That's a small point. It may have been overlooked by the jury, but it's certainly a statement by the court that would indicate a position by the court regarding the presence of the occurrence of an event, an offense, that would certainly prejudice the defense's case. Its burden is on the prosecutor to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. So we submit that was also trial error. Also, the issue of the motion in limine, we feel that the early morning incident of the 10th of April was an event that should not have been admitted. It was irrelevant to the prima facie case. Was essentially, we argued, it was constituted a earlier case of alleged abuse. But also, the court's reasoning in admitting it, and of course, well, there were inconsistencies in what the state argued and what the court ruled, but essentially it argued that the admission went to the issue of consent. That is, the defense of consent, and there was, in the record, there was a discussion between defense counsel and the court. The position of the defense was that there was no defense of consent, that is, consent to sexual penetration by strong compulsion, which defense would see as a consent to sex by strong compulsion. Defense's position was there was reasonable doubt as to the issue of any kind of non-consensual sex. That is, the act was a consensual one, as opposed to there being a consent to a penetration by strong compulsion. Defense felt that because of the absence of medical testimony, inconsistencies in testimony of the witnesses, that the defense could perhaps rest, or could make the defendant could exercise his decision not to testify. And defense's viewing of the record indicates that there were substantial inconsistencies and failures of state did not even call the medical examiner. Defense called her, and much of what she said was inconsistent with what the complainant had testified to or had said to the police officers. Yes. All right. I'm sorry.
How much time did he have on rebuttal?
Yeah.
You don't have any time.
Yeah, that's fine.
We'll allow you a couple minutes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima, on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Now, in affirming defendant's conviction in this case, the ICC reviewed six issues raised by defendant, most of which related to evidentiary-type matters. But with the exception of one, which you talked about earlier, which was the specific unanimity instruction and defendant's contention that the circuit court failed to provide one. Now, in the first issue raised by defendant, defendant claimed that the circuit court abuses discretion in admitting his gun into evidence because it was irrelevant and substantially prejudicial. However, the ICA agreed with us that his gun being admitted was relevant to the intent and restraint elements of the kidnapping offense. Now, what we argued below and what we're arguing here now is that the gun shows the intent of defendant to terrorize the CW. He had made an implicit threat, as counsel had raised, while talking to his friend Andrew over the telephone in front of the CW.
All of that, I take it, Mr. Tsushima, goes to the relevance of, and therefore the admissibility of the first April 10 incident. Is that right?
The first April 10th incident being the sex assault and...
Let me refresh my recollection.
Sure, okay.
The one that the defendant tried to exclude by motion in limine and that the court allowed in. Where there the event taking place in the apartment in which there was the difference of opinion over the significance of the photograph.
Oh, correct.
That one.
Yes. The gun actually admission was going towards the offenses, the incident offenses, and towards that intent, not towards the earlier.
The defendant moved to exclude, I mean, via motion in limine, that first encounter in the apartment that occurred on April 10. The state argued that it was relevant and more probative than prejudicial. And the trial court ruled that all of that evidence could come in. Based on the state of the record with respect to that incident, the first April 10 incident, could the jury have convicted the defendant of kidnapping as charged in the indictment?
No, we would disagree.
Why?
Well, for one, I don't believe the trial deputy developed any facts that would fulfill the elements necessary for the kidnapping. While there was testimony that Linnell was taken down or shoved down or thrown down during that incident, I don't think any testimony was elicited or attempted to be elicited as to defendant's intent. In fact, I think the testimony was pretty...
Isn't state of mind generally inferred circumstantially?
Yeah, and circumstantially, in this case, what the defendant ended up doing was discussing his previous obsession of who's this new boyfriend that she's dating. And that kind of inquiry wouldn't meet the necessary intent for kidnapping or any of the enumerated intents.
During this event, this incident, Linnell testified that the defendant grabbed her from behind, covered her mouth with his hands in order to muffle her screams, dropped her to the ground, slammed her head against the tile, asked, "Who are you fucking? Who are you fucking?" tore the cellular phone from her ear, hit her across the chin with the phone, and resumed his queries regarding her sexual activities. I paraphrase. Could the jury have convicted the defendant of kidnapping under the subsection charged in the indictment based on that testimony?
Which is to terrorize? I would disagree. I would say in the way I would say not, given the way the evidence was presented in this case, and as counsel pointed out, also argued in closing. I think it was made clear.
Forget about closing for the moment.
Okay, for the moment.
If the jury heard it, digested it, and believed it, would that evidence satisfy the elements of the offense of terroristic threatening with intent to terror? I'm sorry, kidnapping. By virtue of restraint with intent to terrorize?
I would still disagree. I would say the trial deputy didn't develop or inquire further into that incident except to bring out the flow of the incident as it occurred.
Adduced additional evidence or not. Was what I just paraphrased to you sufficient to convict as to kidnapping with intent to terrorize?
No, I would still disagree. I don't believe it would meet the dual, the intent as well as the physical act.
Indulge me and assume arguendo, although I understand that you disagree, but assume arguendo that that evidence was sufficient to convict the defendant of kidnapping with intent to terrorize. Could the prosecution make an effective election during closing argument?
I think the way our sales specifically written is that the election should be made at the closing of the case in chief.
At or before the close of the case in chief. Closing argument is after all of that.
Right. So under those,
it's too late during closing argument to make an effective election, isn't it?
Yeah, I would agree.
So your position in your brief then, that the election was made in closing argument, would be incorrect?
That would be incorrect. That was, I would at this point in time, say poorly worded.
If someone grabs a person from behind and throws that person to the floor, would a reasonable person be able to say that constituted restraint?
On those facts alone?
Yes.
With nothing more as to what led to that physical altercation or whatever that you're presenting, I would say not. I would say not on that alone, but within the context of the occurrence.
You would say not.
I would say not.
Would a reasonable person say that would be restraint? Not saying you're not reasonable, but using a hypothetical.
Without additional facts, I would also hope not without additional facts.
All right, I understand your position.
Thank you, Justice.
In reference to the admission of the gun, you were speaking to that earlier, and you used the term implicit threat. Was there an implicit threat regarding the gun?
I believe we argued that there was, or we are arguing that there is, because while counsel said that the conversation with Andrew dealt with merely his discussion. Defendant's conversation with Andrew dealt with merely the discussion of, oh, remember that thing you hid, or, you know, I found it, I have it, and that's it. Actually, not true. There's also a statement directly following that where he says, this is going to be a hostage situation. You're the only one who's going to talk, who can talk me out of this. I think the statements combined together does give an implicit threat to Linnell, and I think she did take it that way.
What did she say? What was her testimony?
Her testimony was, I believe she was asked by the trial deputy, did you want to leave? And she said, yes, why didn't you? Well, I felt this was leading up to the point where he would kill me. And it was just following this testimony of what he just said.
Was that all in reference to the weapon? Was that her understanding? Is that what came out in evidence?
I don't think she made specific reference that her belief that he was willing or threatening to kill her was directly related to the gun, but chronologically the line of questioning followed in such a manner.
So the term hostage that he used, that she overheard?
Yes.
Implicated the gun as far as she was concerned?
When it followed directly after the conversation of, or the discussion of, I found it, I have it, and immediately following that statement, and this is going to be a hostage situation, or I think we have a hostage, I forget, I'm not wording it quite correctly, but something like to the effect of, this is a hostage situation. And again, along that point, defendant didn't object to any testimony of the gun or testimony regarding the gun. It was just as to submission of the gun itself. So his argument actually just comes down to prejudice because the gun itself was admitted into evidence, which there was no support. There is no authority to support such a notion.
If we could change the subject for the moment, what was the basis of the prosecution's objection to the defendant's attempt to cross-examine Linnell with respect to the contents of her statement to Detective Kim?
I remember correctly, I believe it was a hearsay objection. I'm not sure if you have it right in front of you, which part you're referring to. This was the cross...
Yeah, this, as I recall, the defendant was seeking to lay foundation for evidence with respect to whether Linnell stated to Detective Kim that she had been raped.
I believe it was a... It mischaracterizes the transcript objection.
Take a look at if you've got the August 8th transcript, pages yes. 214 and 215.
Yes. Is it the one in the middle of the page 214?
Well, I confess I don't have the actual pages in front of me.
I believe it was there are two objections made right around the area that you're speaking of. One of the objections was asked and answered.
Right.
And the other objection that I see in the middle of the page, I believe, was mischaracterized as the transcript.
I think the asked and answered is the one
that's
of greater interest
of.
To me.
Yeah. Sorry, could you?
You know, I may be leading you astray with respect to the pages.
I might have
so
taken
let's,
us
let's,
there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I mean pages 211 to 214. You know, this is the exchange between... between defense counsel and Linnell over the matter of refreshing her recollection.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yes.
Yeah. What was the basis of the prosecution's objection to that line of questioning?
That does lead into the one, the ask and answer question, right?
Right.
So I believe that was the basis somewhere in the middle of... defense counsel's line of questioning.
See, I read that colloquy as an attempt, I mean, among other things, as an attempt by the defense to comply with Rule 613. Do you?
Yes.
Wasn't the defendant entitled to attempt to comply with Rule 613?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I
did the defendant succeed in complying with Rule 613?
I think, if I may, when defense counsel was doing this line of questioning, albeit this one question or this part was sustained, this one objection was sustained, I don't believe the court completely prevented defense counsel from further attempting to cross-examine the witness, Linnell in this matter, or in this instance. I think basically there's a plethora of other situations where defense counsel was able to make his point that she was making inconsistent statements that she had made earlier, or inconsistent two statements she had made earlier. So while I do agree this is one where maybe he was denied an opportunity to get the specific response he wanted out of this witness, I think he was
far from... Well, the defendant was never able to develop any record with respect to the contents of Detective Kim's... with respect to the statement that Linnell made to Detective Kim on the subject of what she did and didn't say to him. Isn't that right?
I would say it's correct that defense counsel didn't pursue it further, but I don't believe the court denied him the opportunity to pursue it further. I don't believe the court said, you're not going to be able to use that transcript to cross-examine her in this manner.
I'm looking at what I'm sure is on page 214.
Okay.
Question by defense counsel. Would you like me to show you a copy of the section of the statement that refreshes your recollection about what you said? Prosecution, Your Honor, I believe that's been asked and answered. She gave her answer. I personally couldn't find an answer to that question. Okay, sustained. So that cut off any opportunity the defendant had to question or to show the complainant the statement that she made to Detective Kim and to question her with respect to whether that statement refreshed her recollection. Isn't that so?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't believe the court's ruling on the trial attorney's objection equated or rose to the level of denying him the opportunity to cross-examine. I think
you don't read that as a ruling by the court forbidding defense counsel from showing the complainant the statement that she made to Detective Kim.
Well, because actually, upon looking at it again, her response was yes, that she did want to see it.
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
Let's see.
So I don't see that as a denial of the opportunity to cross-examine her on this.
The last question that defense counsel asked was, if you want, I can refresh your recollection. Then the court intervenes. Mm-hmm. Then the complainant makes a statement. Then defense counsel says, okay, but what I'm interested in is what you told Detective Kim and what you remember. And would you like me to, you're right, Linnell says, yes, please. And he finishes his question, would you like me to show you a copy of the section, the statement that refreshes your recollection? She's already asked to see her statement. There's an objection by the prosecution. I believe that's been asked and answered. Okay, sustained.
Right.
So defense counsel wasn't allowed to show Linnell the statement that she made to Detective Kim.
I would respectfully disagree. I would say he was told that question had been asked. She wants to see it. I think that was defense counsel's opportunity to approach with the transcript and cross-examine her. I think from what we're reading, it's not very clear because of the mix up in the order, maybe, or the...
So it's your position that after okay sustained, had he wished to do so, Mr. Model, facing no threat of objection and without interference from the court, could have said, I show you what's been marked as defendant's exhibit, whatever it was, for identification, and ask you if you can identify it. Yes, that's the statement I made to Detective Kim. Defense counsel was free to do that?
I believe so. I believe on this record, yes.
Mr. Tsushima, yes. Mr. Model argued that on three occasions, I think, the court instructed the jury to disregard testimony. You recall that?
Correct, yes.
So that was in relation to the court's pretrial order that no prior incidents of or testimony of physical abuse be admitted at trial? Do you recall?
Yes.
And apparently the complainant and Tabitha, on three separate occasions during their testimony, referred to or inferred that or indicated that there was prior abuse by the petitioner.
Yes.
And so the court gave a cautionary instruction to the jury three separate times.
Correct.
And the ICA said that was all inadvertent. I can see that once might be inadvertent, even though there's a pre-trial order, I assume all counsel would follow and they would instruct all witnesses to follow. But what about the second time this happens and the court has to again give a cautionary instruction on a pre-trial order issued before trial started? Wouldn't that cause prejudice?
Not such that would require reversal.
Okay.
There would be prejudice.
What about the third time?
No, it was actually, yeah, you're correct. There were three instances, two by one witness, one by the other.
Yeah. And each time the court gave a cautionary instruction to the jury.
Yeah. And in fact, the court also gave an additional curative instruction.
So even at the time of final instruction, the court again reminded the jury about that testimony.
Well, to instruct them to disregard it.
Yes.
And that they're not...
I agree that sometimes an instruction to disregard, or usually instruction to disregard, will be followed. But is there a risk that when the court has to do it three different times, it doesn't... What it in fact does is imprint in the jury's mind that kind of testimony?
Well, I think there's really no way around it. There's no other way to cure it other than to instruct the jurors and to order them to, or instruct them that they are to follow these instructions and that they're presumed to follow such. I do appreciate the point you're making. And I think the court recognized it as well, which is why they added the additional curative instruction, which counsel agreed to. And I think they even edited it to a certain extent to fit what they desired, and that was to remind the jurors that they're not here to decide whether a defendant was a good or bad husband, but that the state is held to prove the elements beyond a reasonable doubt, and that you're to decide dispassionately. And I don't know what more else the court could have done, considering...
Well, the defense asked for a mistrial.
Yes.
What about that?
No, I believe it was correct for the court to deny that motion. It was really just a blurt, and I don't believe it painted a defendant in such a picture that it was going to overwhelm the jury that we need to convict this guy who hits her. In fact, the facts of the offense itself were so egregious that those facts alone, the evidence was strong enough that that's the reason I would believe this jury would convict. And that these little utterances of, I don't want to take them out of context of the way, but something like hit or something to that effect, or having another boyfriend who would abuse me, which actually wasn't a direct reference to even defendant. He didn't say another boyfriend like my husband or something like that. It was just very vague, I would argue. Thank you, Justice. And I believe I am running out of time here. I believe we more or less touched upon all the issues raised by defendant before the ICA, and which the ICA found to have be without merit. So based on the applicable and relevant law, we do respectfully request this court to affirm the judgment of the ICA. Thank you.
This will hold you a couple minutes.
In regard to one point concerning the termination of the defense cross-examination when the objection of ask and answer was made, the
interaction leading up to that is somewhat confusing, and I think a careful reading would show that when the witness, the complainant, said yes, please, she wasn't referring to her interest in receiving a copy so it could be refreshed. The prior question was by the judge, please ask a question. So I
before that, statement is, or statement to the complainant is, but what I'm interested in is what you told Detective Kim and what you remember, and would you like me to? And you didn't have a chance,
correct,
to get the words, show you the statement that you gave to Detective Kim out. Complainant says, okay, then would you please, court says, excuse me, ask her a question. Complainant says, yes, please. That could even be the end of the sentence she was in the middle of when the court interrupted, but you still haven't even mentioned a statement to Detective that she made to Detective Kim. And then you ask, would you like me to show you a copy of the section of the statement that refreshes your recollection about what you said? And that's when the asked and answered objection was made and sustained.
Correct. Thank you.
So that was your first opportunity to allude out loud to the statement that that the complainant made to Detective Kim.
Yes, I believe so. That was my reading. Also, I just wanted to urge the court to examine, again, the inconsistencies and the tenuousness outside of the testimony of the victim, which is rock solid in some cases. And admittedly, jurors may have found it rock solid in this, but with the what petitioner submits is the many points of error that cumulatively it undermined the defense case. And it would appear, although jurors may have disagreed, there were ample areas where the testimony of the complainant as well as other witnesses really undermined the strength of the case. And what was left was the assertions that there were these prior instances of abuse, which anyone understandably could relate to. This is a serious problem in our society. And in spite of the court's curative instructions, we feel that the case was so undermined that it would warrant an opportunity for a new trial. And again, it was a third time. And this is their defendant's rights. Of course, there is administration of justice, the expense of a new trial, but nevertheless, those things are in. And at some point, you have to conclude that curative instructions, I would imagine, as the, Your Honor pointed out, is it the first, second, third, fourth instruction? Where does it actually, where do those instructions actually become not effective in eliminating the impression of a very horrible allegation against an individual outside of the core facts of the case? So, nothing further. Thank you.
So, well, let me just ask you one real quick question, or a couple of questions.
Yes.
Try to make it quick. You said priority-wise, the admission of the gun was a priority for you in terms of the importance of issues, right?
I think that was an important issue, yes.
So you didn't object to the reference to the gun, testimony concerning the gun. You did object to the admission of the gun.
Yes, Your Honor, and there's nothing on the record reflecting a request to strike the testimony, but the usual process is evidence may come in, but it's usually tied in. And in the absence of really the ability to carry out discovery in criminal cases and find out exactly what witnesses say,
it appears that the gun was relevant. It was brought to the home, it was placed in the bed.
The night before, yeah. The early morning, yes.
Right, okay, so and she knew about the gun. Living with him and...
No, I don't believe she did. There's no... All she heard was the discussion between Andrew Kim and the complainant at the time of the alleged event. She was unaware that he had brought it there.
Did you say to any authority regarding the actual admission of the gun You indicate the gun has enormous impact to the jurors in a deliberation room, the gun in and of itself, with the ammunition in the clip.
Particularly when there's no other evidence, physical evidence,
no.
Yes.
I'm sorry. The mere admission of the gun that was taken into the deliberation room, did you have authority cited to indicate that act of having the gun is error in the deliberation room?
No, I found no case where that was ruled, Your Honor. However, I think that in terms of the balancing of the probativeness and the prejudice, I think a gun with a clip would be something of heavy weight that warranted, and I request that the court consider that. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement.